This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Noblis Insights panel on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today's panel is titled Leading the Way, Federal Green Initiatives. President Obama's Executive Order 13514, Federal Leadership in Environmental, Energy, and Economic Performance, is aimed at improving the overall sustainability of the federal government. All federal agencies are required to inventory their greenhouse gas emissions, set targets to reduce their emissions by 2020, and develop a plan for meeting a wide range of goals for improving sustainability. Here's your host, Beverly Kirk.
Thanks for joining us and welcome to the show. Joining me on the panel, Stephen Leeds, Senior Counselor to the Administrator for GSA. As Senior Counselor, Leeds advises and assists the Administrator on a variety of GSA's enterprise initiatives. He also coordinates the activities of regional administrators. Marguerite Coffey, Executive Secretariat of Green Diplomacy Initiative at the State Department. She is the Director of the Office of Management Policy, Rightsizing, and Innovation. She served in the former Office of Management Policy for 8 years prior to becoming Director of the new MPRI in 2007. Dr. Thomas Armstrong, Senior Advisor on Climate Change, Department of the Interior. Dr. Armstrong is responsible for the implementation of Secretary Salazar's Executive Order on Climate Change, SO 3289, as well as the development of the Department's climate change-related policies, organizational elements, and budget strategies. Mary Pleffner, Director of Administrative Services, Department of Commerce. She oversees departmental policy and programs for a variety of administrative functions, including energy and environmental management, real and personal property, and travel and transportation, among others. She also has operational responsibility for Commerce Headquarters and is currently overseeing the Herbert C. Hoover Building Renovation and Modernization Project on behalf of the department, a complex 12-year, $958 million project. Dr. David Evans, Director of the Center for Sustainability, Earth, Energy, and Climate at Noblis. Dr. Evans is responsible for building company-wide science-based initiatives. His initial efforts are focused on an emerging Noblis program to aid federal, state, and local governments in developing strategies to adapt to climate change. He is also working to expand existing programs in ocean, atmosphere, space, energy, and environmental science and engineering. We're also hoping that Federal Environmental Executive Michelle Moore will be able to join us later in the program. Welcome to everyone. Let's get started. President Obama signed the Executive Order 13514 last October. It outlines a strategy for sustainability in the federal government. The U.S. government is the single largest energy consumer in the American economy, according to the White House, spending more than $24 billion on electricity and fuel in 2008 alone. So how does sustainability relate to your agency's mission? Dr. Armstrong, let's start with you.
Thanks, Beverly. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. The DOI mission across the board is to protect and sustain a broad range of natural resources, both living and non-living, as well as historical and cultural resources. And we do that through the protection mandates of 8 resource management bureaus and 1 science wing at the department. And to put that into context, we manage 1 out of every 5 acres of the country. We have significant trust responsibilities in insular territories or island territories in the Pacific Ocean as well. We're the largest water purveyor in the world through the Bureau of Reclamation. We have significant threatened and endangered species protection responsibilities through the Endangered Species Act. We're responsible for sustaining and protecting Native American resources, both on and off of Bureau of Indian Affairs-led reservations. And we're also responsible for the management of significant renewable and non-renewable energy resources across the country as well. So there, as you can see, just based on that sort of small portfolio, providing resource sustainability is a big part of our mission.
Indeed it is. Ms. Coffey, how is it at the State Department? Talk about sustainability as it relates there.
Sure. I think most of all, our mission is, as part of our diplomatic program, is to share America's story abroad. And we do that by modeling our environmentalism. I think the American environmentalism is a very, very important message. Mm-hmm. We are dedicated to the preservation of the environment at home and around the world. The work that we do particularly involves improving our facilities, our diplomatic missions abroad and their operations. We focus on engaging the public abroad and sharing with them the things that we do to make our embassy facilities more environmentally responsive and responsible.
Ms. Pleffner, I want to talk to you about Commerce's sustainability plan.
Thank you. Commerce's mission is to advance economic growth by helping businesses and manufacturing become more innovative and thus more competitive both home and abroad. And through doing this, they create jobs. Environmental stewardship and sustainability runs through all of our operations. It's a theme on our balanced scorecard. We have a number of operating units that are very focused on sustainable efforts. We have NIST with an improving sustainable and life cycle information-based manufacturing. They set the standards for industry for carbon footprints, for green aspects and green standards. ITA has a sustainable manufacturing initiative, and that fosters domestic and international conditions to allow U.S. companies to compete in the sustainable marketplace overseas. It also runs through our own internal management and our own operations and programs.
Steve Leitz at GSA, you have a big job in helping all of the agencies meet their sustainability goals. And GSA has created a tool that I'll talk about later in the program and question you about to help everyone meet the order of this executive order. Talk about GSA's responsibility in all of this.
When the president signed the executive order on October 5th, he made sustainability part of the core mission of every agency in government. GSA's mission is to support the prime missions of every agency of government, using our expertise and bringing to bear that expertise to find solutions for the needs of the other agencies. So we are, as a prime element of our mission, supporting the sustainability goals of every other agency in government. We do that in multiple ways. We own and lease approximately 360 million square feet of office space. And through our Office of Government-Wide High Performance Green Buildings and through our public buildings service, we are working on sustainability with innovative ideas, a green proving ground to test out new technologies and to assist in the disposition of underutilized and excess properties. And then through our federal acquisition service, where we acquire about $65 billion of goods and services a year, we are working on greening the supply chain.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Evans, Noblis is a corporate entity that is very involved in the environment. Talk to me about the sustainability issue from the corporate side and how you have a vested interest in helping the government achieve the results that the president is looking for.
Thank you very much. We think that the president's order last October actually set the government out in a leadership position, a sort of lead by example in dealing with difficult questions having to do with sustainability. It's a way of dealing with climate change, it's a way with dealing with energy problems and a variety of other issues that are affecting us. And Noblis has traditionally stepped up to help the government deal with some of the more difficult problems, mm-hmm. if not the routine problems. And we feel that this problem, that quite frankly, is worth all of the resources that we can put behind it. It seems clear to us that if we're to be successful in developing a sustainable future, that it will take the efforts not only of the government, but also of the private sector. And as a nonprofit, Noblis sits sort of in a happy middle space in between the full-fledged private sector, if you will, on the one hand, and the government agency on the other. And so we see ourselves as having an important role in helping government agencies figure out how to comply with the president's order and to develop sustainable programs over a whole range of activities that I hope we have a chance to talk about today.
The GO 13514, it has so many aspects to it. And I'm just going to mention a couple of the items. It calls for a 2% annual reduction of petroleum consumption in agencies with fleets of more than 20 vehicles. It also calls for a 2% reduction in water usage, both potable and for industrial uses, all this by FY 2020. It deals with non-hazardous solid waste, green buildings, and calls for 95% of all new contracts to meet energy efficient standards. This seems like an incredibly tall order. How tall is it? And I'll start with you, Steve Leeds, because you just mentioned the enormous amount of building space that GSA is responsible for.
I think it's a tall order, but I think all of us working together can achieve it. One of the beauties of this executive order also, though, is that it asked each agency to set out in its strategic sustainability strategic plan how that agency would achieve those goals. Mm-hmm. So it was not a one-size-fits-all. Mm-hmm. And in asking each agency how they would achieve the goals, it allowed each agency to look within, analyze its own core missions and opportunities, and say to CEQ and to the other agencies, this is what we need to do. Again, at GSA, we believe that understanding each agency's core mission and working with each agency, we are better able to also help them achieve those goals in the areas in which we deal.
Ms. Pleffner, what is Commerce doing to forge ahead with the executive order?
We have a great number of initiatives underway. Some of the more notable initiatives is a project that NIST engaged in out in Gaithersburg. They have a research building where three of the buildings have to be well below the water table for various reasons. And they were having to divert the groundwater so that there was not leakage into the buildings. And what they have done is, rather than continue to dump it into the wastewater system, they've diverted it and are running it to their water cooling tower. Mm-hmm. So they are recycling 33,000 gallons of water a year that would otherwise have gone into the wastewater system to provide heating and the water for the heating and cooling system. We have projects throughout the country where we're doing geothermal. We have projects where we're doing solar power in our air stations. We have integrated design. All of our new building is required to be, the goal is LEED Silver. And we do have buildings that exceed that. Our own Herbert C. Humphrey Hoover building downtown, it's an historic building, and we're in the process of renovating it. And we believe we've achieved gold LEEDs, and we are striving for platinum. And that's just a few of the efforts we have going on.
It sounds like you have a lot going on. Now, Ms. Coffey at State?
We've baselined our operations, starting with 2008. Right now, the main state building, the Harry S. Truman building, is undergoing a major renovation. That will be multi-year. We're doing that in segments, and we're committed to LEED certification on that renovation up to the silver standard. We have engaged in a great deal of personal engagement within the building itself. We have a greening council made up of the undersecretaries of state. Certainly, it's chaired by the undersecretary for management and the undersecretary for global affairs, and they meet quarterly, and we talk about all sorts of activities that are going on in the building. I think this is a grassroots operation at State. There are many, many people that believe that have committed themselves to working in a green working environment. We harness that activity. There are many people engaged in working groups. We've just started one that's in our sustainability plan with respect to travel. When you look at it, we absolutely, it's a critical need for our diplomats to engage the international community and travel internationally. But we are also committed to taking a look at that and see how we can reduce the carbon footprint in the travel that we engage. And So we've got many bureaus participating on that level as well. We have started the Greening Embassy Forum in Washington, D.C. We have over 50 embassies involved and committed to reducing their environmental footprint in the city of Washington. The D.C. government is part of that effort as well. And with respect to our missions abroad, our building program, building new embassy and consulates abroad, is committed to LEED standards as well.
Let me follow up. You mentioned the other embassies. Mm-hmm. I find that people might be surprised to know that you're encouraging the folks from other countries who have their embassies here in Washington to do some of the same things that the State Department's being asked to do for its embassies all over the world.
Well, it gets back to the point made before about leading by example. And I think what we're trying to do is promote America's commitment to environmentalism. It's certainly not an American-oriented effort by any means. We have many embassies who are ahead of us, quite frankly, mm-hmm. in terms of their commitment to sustainability and so forth. But I think this forum is definitely an opportunity to exchange best practices. We have a lot to give. We have built about over 70 new embassies in the last 10 years abroad, and we have built them with a mind towards the footprint that we are making and a very firm commitment to environmental sustainability.
And Dr. Armstrong, before I come to you, Steve Leach, you had another point you wanted to make.
When Marguerite was just talking about leading by example, with the executive order, our new administrator, Martha Johnson, has made it a goal for GSA to have a zero environmental footprint in the future, mm-hmm. where we have no negative impact with respect to the environment in all of our activities. So that is a benchmark that she has put forward for us in our efforts on sustainability.
Dr. Armstrong, I would think at Interior you would have probably the largest area to cover in terms of forging ahead and putting all of the parts of the executive order in place.
Well, I don't know if we have the largest challenge, but I will say we are a very distributed organization, and one out of every 5 acres, and I can't say that for every acre we have a facility, but it comes darn close. We have several thousand facilities, very distributed and very remote places in many cases. But I want to go back to Marguerite's point. I agree that we need to lead by example. And at DOI, we see this as an opportunity, not a requirement. And as part of that, we put together a 10-point strategic sustainability plan, which focuses on 10 major sustainability goals, including increasing building energy efficiency in all of our facilities across the country, reducing our vehicle fleet and enhancing our vehicle fleet efficiency, including hybrid and electric vehicles. Increasing water use conservation, a very important point that somebody made before. We're doing that on DOI lands and developing a more sustainable acquisition strategy for acquiring more green buildings on mm-hmm. facilities, both those remote and those in more populated areas of the country. We do have national parks and refuges in some of our cities, our major cities across the country. And developing a more efficient electronic stewardship set of procedures as well. All in all, I think, though, it gets back to Marguerite's point that we'll do all these things because we have the opportunity to do so and it'll make a difference. But those grassroots efforts, I think, are really going to make a major, major impact.
Before we have to take a break, I want to ask about the deadline that just passed. On June 2nd, that was the date that each agency was to submit a strategic sustainability performance plan and provide the details of how they're going to meet the executive order's requirements. How difficult was it to get done? I'm sure it was different for each agency, but Dr. Armstrong, let me ask you that.
Well, I think in one sense it was challenging because we were still in an iterative process with the rest of the government on what the guidance really was, what we did have to do and what we didn't have to do to meet the requirements, but where there was flexibility and opportunity. And I think Steve Leeds said it right. Once we got to the point of realizing that one size didn't fit all of the different agencies, we realized that we had an opportunity to make it flexible and responsive to our very demanding needs.
Ms. Coffey, you're nodding in agreement.
Yes, very much so. I think the Council on Environmental Quality gave us very good guidance, first of all. And I think also the flexibility that we had in order to reach the goals that they're asking us to reach was very, very important. It took us about 3 months to develop ours at state. But again, I think the involvement in it was nobody had to be compelled to do this. These were things that not only were in train, but people were very committed to these goals and getting them accomplished on behalf of the department.
Ms. Plefner?
I think the workforce in general is very committed to sustainability and a green government and promoting green places to work. So setting up teams across all of our operating units, we had no problem pulling people together, getting ideas on the table, and looking how we can move forward, especially utilizing a lot of the work that we're doing, particularly in NOAA, NIST, and NTIA. So I think it was an opportunity more than a challenge.
All right, we're going to pause here. You're listening to Leading the Way, Federal Green Initiative, sponsored by Noblis. We'll be right back.
Sustaining our planet's environment will take more than recycling or changing the thermostat. For real change to take place, large organizations must lead the way. Noblis is assisting government agencies and businesses with solutions that help reduce environmental impacts and promote sustainable operations. The President's Executive Order 13514 challenges the federal government to lead in sustainability. Agencies must calculate their greenhouse gas emissions and energy use, then develop a plan for meeting sustainability goals. Noblis thought leaders have developed the GSA Carbon Footprint Tool to help agencies calculate their greenhouse gas emissions and energy use and evaluate options for reduction. Noblis, a nonprofit science, technology, and strategy organization, helps clients solve some of their toughest challenges in healthcare, national security, enterprise transformation, transportation, and sustainability. Noblis, for the best of reasons.
Welcome back to Leading the Way, the Federal Green Initiatives sponsored by Noblis. I'm Beverly Kirk. Our panel has been talking about the Executive Order 13514, and we were specifically speaking before the break about sustainability and the deadline of June 2nd that each agency had to submit the Strategic Sustainability Performance Plan. We are joined now by Federal Environmental Executive Michelle Moore. Michelle, thank you for being here, and I want to start with you. You received these plans. What can you tell us about what you're seeing that agencies have presented to you?
Thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to be with you all here today. We've been very excited by what we've seen so far, and of course, you know, at this point in the process, ourselves at CEQ and OMB are reviewing the plans. You know, ultimately, they'll be approved sometime over the course of the next 45 days. But we're seeing some consistent themes. You know, definitely a theme of employee involvement and engagement. Are really looking to the extraordinary men and women in federal and military service to help us all get this done. And then we're also seeing a very consistent theme of looking at opportunities in federal buildings. Of course, the 500,000 federal buildings that we own and operate around the country and around the world are a big part of our footprint and a big source of opportunity as it relates to energy efficiency and also looking at innovative solutions like cool roofs, green roofs, and installing solar power and other renewable energy on federal properties.
Let me follow up on that by saying, you know, it's one thing to write a plan, quite another to actually implement it. What do you anticipate being some of the challenges of actually implementing the plans that you have in hand?
Well, of course, you know, where the rubber meets the road is getting the work done, not just here inside the Beltway, but also in the field. Of course, you know, more than 80% of our total footprint from a people perspective is outside of Washington, D.C. So I think a challenge that we're all going to have, not only the agency community, but also the work that we're doing under the Green Gov banner to implement the President's executive order is going to be to make sure that we're reaching out beyond headquarters and engaging the men and women in federal and military service around the country and around the world to help us move this forward. Clearly, behavioral changes, what we do in our offices, do we turn our computers and speakers off at night? Are we consistently recycling? You know, with our interaction with buildings, with federal vehicles, or that that behavioral component is an important part of our performance and where a lot of the low-hanging fruit is going to be for any of the federal agencies.
Dr. David Evans from Noblis, talk from the perspective of a nonprofit about this this gap between writing a plan and actually implementing it. What can government agencies learn from folks in the nonprofit world and in the private sector?
Well, you know, I think there's really quite a lot in common that we all have to face. It's easy to develop a plan sometimes that looks pretty, it has a nice cover, it sits on the shelf and gathers dust. The real problem, of course, is in helping to develop a process that takes you forward and lets you actually implement the plan and achieve the goals that you've laid out to start with. Noblis has been fortunate in being able to help the Office of the Secretary of Defense in helping them develop their plan. And we were very encouraged in the course of that process that the plan that was being developed was one that the very diverse set of participants in that department were engaged in and are looking forward to developing the implementation plan as they go forward. So as you've heard from some of the other departments, we found that that there's a significant engagement of the people who are involved and some real enthusiasm for the kinds of activities that are being called for. And we believe that that having a plan that has that level of enthusiasm in its construction goes a long way towards continuing that as you move into an implementation phase.
Steve Leitz from GSA. GSA has a tool to help agencies manage the greenhouse gases required by the executive order. Talk about how that's supposed to help agencies in this process.
The carbon footprint tool, we actually had a demonstration project on that this week and had, I think it was 21 agencies come over and take a look at it. It's available free to the agencies, mm-hmm. And it will be pre-populated with a lot of information on their travel, air travel in particular. Mm-hmm. It will provide a kind of a vanilla employee commuting survey that they can use to help in figuring out their some scope 3 reductions. And it will be the vehicle by which they can then populate with their own information and utilize that to help in their in determining not only their baseline but also some of their projection numbers. And I do want to make one comment on Dr. Evans. One of the things that we're finding is that we believe that you have to have an environmental sustainability management plan for the entire agency in figuring out exactly how you're then going to implement all the things in the strategic plan so that it becomes part and parcel of everything that is done within the agency.
Ms. Moore, I want to follow up with you. Dr. Evans is talking about the ability of the agencies to work their plans. Tell me, is it at all possible for agencies in using this GSA tool to make the process easier for them?
Absolutely. We've certainly heard that from agencies who've used the GSA tool to help develop some of the requirements that are in the sustainability plan, looking at what their scope 3 greenhouse gas reduction targets are for indirect greenhouse gas emissions from things like employee travel or like employee commuting. And overall, the role that GSA plays, certainly for the civilian community and for the military community as well, as being the federal government's landlord in many instances, and a source of incredible expertise in purchasing, for instance, and acquisition, is going to play an extremely important role for all of the agencies who work with GSA in achieving their sustainability goals overall. We see them as being absolutely central in this partnership.
You mentioned Scope 3, and that deals with GHG emissions from goods and services vendors and suppliers actually supply to the agencies. That's not something that agencies have a lot of control over. So do you anticipate that being a more difficult area of the executive order to have the agencies follow?
Well, one of the aspects of the executive order, and this was in the recommendations that were in Section 13, actually, asked GSA and working with an interagency community in a working group format to look at the question of measuring and managing greenhouse gases in our supply chain. And so we're looking forward to continuing that dialogue. And just like what you see from many organizations in the private sector, leaders in that community who have begun looking at greenhouse gases as a way to green the supply chain and drive out waste, There's been some good success there. And we see it as a potential opportunity to work very effectively with small business, with innovative startups, in helping to make good on the policy aims of the executive order that are really related to fostering a clean energy economy and supporting American entrepreneurship. Because certainly with $500 billion in purchases of goods and services every year, you know, the federal government has the potential to be the kind of customer to a great little entrepreneurial idea that's going to turn it into an extraordinary American enterprise that's creating clean energy jobs.
I want to move on to talk about adaptation at both the federal and state level. Can you all share your insights or thoughts about adaptation to climate change and energy efficiency's usage? And Dr. Armstrong, I'm going to start with you on this.
Yeah, and I like the way the question was phrased. Excuse me. Thinking about adaptation linked and climate change linked to energy efficiencies. For us at the Department of the Interior, and I'm speaking more broadly for the federal government through the U.S. Global Change Research Program as well, which I sit on for the Department of the Interior, we envision the climate change portfolio to be twofold. There's a mitigation element and an adaptation element. And I think the real issue here with EO 13514 is it's aimed at maximizing energy efficiencies and thereby reducing our output of greenhouse gases, which most people consider to be a mitigation action. At DOI, I can't really point to any specific cases where on the adaptation side we have a linkage between adaptation and energy efficiency use. But what I can say is that if we can mitigate our greenhouse gases through the guidance and the spirit of EO 13514 or any other element of the policy or legislation, we can minimize the need for adaptation in the long run. The bottom line is, no matter what we do today, we are going to face a changing climate tomorrow for the next 40, 50 to 100 years. The science is clear on that. But what we can do is, by starting a long-term investment into mitigation of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere today, we can minimize the need for adaptation, relatively speaking, tomorrow and over the next 100 years. And so there's a direct linkage between mitigation activities and the spirit of EO 13514, energy efficiencies and adaptation. And I think that's where the linkage is for us.
Are there any adaptation planning activities that you're going to share in terms of embarking on it now or in the future? Can you talk a little bit about that at Interior?
And I have to say that, again, because we are distributed across the country, we have lots of good local examples of adaptation that's going on. And let me give you a couple of really quick examples. And these involve co-benefits. And that's one of the things that is one of our low-hanging fruit, is looking at those places where we can do adaptation, where there's multiple benefits. It's not just going to be adapting one element of a system to climate change, but something else comes out of it as well. And one of those examples is our California carbon capture farm in the San Joaquin Delta of California. In that area, sea level rise or impending sea level rise and agricultural use of the land is causing a subsidence issue, a sinking of the land, and a rising of sea level, which really does impinge upon the safety and well-being of a mass series of levees out there and water availability for the residents of California. The work that we've been doing through the U.S. Geological Survey and the Department of the Interior has been looking at using native plants to actually help the land rise and recover. And some of the co-benefits of doing that adaptation effort are we're planting native plants, which are good and important for native fisheries and nurseries for migratory birds. And as we found out, it also is sequestering a lot of carbon as well, about 9 times what the agricultural land was sequestering. So there was co-benefits in that adaptation effort. Another example of this has been an alligator national wildlife refuge in Albemarle Sound, North Carolina, where the impending sea level rise predictions that we're looking at mean that what might be land today will be water tomorrow. And our adaptation plan for that refuge includes land acquisitions. But those land acquisitions are also going to be bringing in lands that the refuge wanted for breeding grounds for fish and migratory birds along the East Coast as well. So again, we see co-benefits in a lot of the adaptation efforts that we've got going on, all that get back to the spirit and the intent of EO 13514.
Mary Plefner from Commerce, talk about, we don't necessarily think of climate change as it relates to the Commerce Department. Talk about what your agency is doing in terms of adaptation planning.
Well, the Department of Commerce is a rather eclectic agency. And within Commerce, we have NOAA. And NOAA has formed the Climate Services Office. And this office will integrate their climate research, observations, modeling, predictions, and assessments, and provide an integrated scientific foundation for requests for data. And we get millions of requests from the public and private sector. So that is one very tangible thing that we're doing. NIST and NASA are in a joint effort to develop a new climate satellite. We are improving our weather data and prediction and focused on the climate change research through our sustainable manufacturing efforts in NIST and ITA. We are reaching out to industry to help them for sustainable manufacturing. We are building a net zero building, and that building is constructed in the design of a typical home, and it will be net zero. It will consume, it will create as much energy as it consumes. So that is something that we hope to prototype and that would be used by anyone down the road. It's groundbreaking research. We are working with the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy on adaptation strategies. And NTIS has developed the Federal Energy Data Management Program, which collects, monitors, and baselines a building energy usage. And this is being prototyped at our headquarters building downtown, because being able to measure something is the first step in being able to see if the strategies you're using are truly being effective.
That's really exciting, having a net zero building that produces as much energy as it uses. That's fascinating. Now, Marguerite Coffey at State, what's going on there?
Well, we have a lot of things going on. We pay very, very close attention to the unique environment of our facilities abroad. We're in 283 locations around the world. Let me give you a very, very brief survey of what we've been doing. In Tokyo and Geneva, we've installed magnetic levitation chillers on the roofs of our embassies.
Magnetic levitation chillers?
Yes.
You're going to have to explain that.
That's very high tech. Chillers, of course, cool the embassy environment internally, and these levitation chillers, they're magnetic, rather than having grease and gears working and making a lot of noise and so forth. It's a new technology. It's a very efficient technology. We will adapt it to other locations as well, but there's where we have piloted. We have vegetative roofs in Athens, Berlin, Kyiv, and Guangzhou. We have district heating in Stockholm, Moscow, and Oslo. Solo thermal water heaters in Canberra, Frankfurt, Santiago, and Mali. And LED lighting in our missions in Frankfurt, Bogota, and Taipei. These, of course, respond to local conditions. Mm-hmm. We have different needs in different areas of the world. But that's what we're doing in order to provide, you know, our sustainability program adapted to the local environment.
Dr. Evans, let me ask you, she just mentioned different needs in different areas. So how do you assess the threat of climate change depending on where you are?
That's a really good question. It hits really at the heart of what I think the adaptation to climate change is really all about. Adaptation is a process that's going to happen in particular places. We talk about mitigation strategies for climate change, and you talk about reducing your carbon input, reducing your footprint, reducing greenhouse gases overall. It's a kind of global concept in a way. But adaptation has to do with people, where people live and where people work, and so it's focused very much on particular places. So you hear in interior, for example, examples from this delta or that particular refuge. In fact, we're finding that that adaptation happens where people exist, and the problems are different depending upon where they exist. It may have to do with changes in stormwater. It may have to do with changes in the length of the droughts on average. It may have to do with increased numbers of heat stress days, or for that matter, the intensity of winter storms. In Washington here, we may be adapting to more frequent winter storms as a consequence of climate change. And one of the things that a number of private sector firms can bring to bear in helping lots of folks deal with this issue is this general notion of systems engineering. If you take stormwater management, drought management, heat stress, changes in the availability of water, sea level rise, and so on, you realize that they affect all of the infrastructure systems in any particular place. And you don't want to just fix your stormwater system, let's say, if you also need to deal about your potable water system, or if you need to deal with snow removal, or if you need to deal with runoff. And so being able to approach a facility or a place from the perspective of its comprehensive plan and deal with many of the aspects of a changing environment that will depend upon what we expect to be happening based on the fact that, well, we know that it's going to be warm as it is in Washington in the summertime and cold in the winter. Changes in that are built into our building codes and engineering standards, very much across the board kind of perspective. And so one of the things that we're finding is that those perspectives differ from place to place, and they require a kind of a comprehensive or systems approach to successfully dealing with them.
Steve Leeds from GSA, it seems like we've gone around the table here and the various agencies are working to adapt. Is it going to be easier for some agencies than others, do you think?
I think each agency will find different ways to adapt. The comment that was made by Dr. Armstrong about mitigation, we're all going to be working on mitigation. We at GSA will focus a lot on using greater renewable energy. That will be a primary focus of ours. And the testing of various innovative technologies, I think, will be very important to see what works. We're doing a lot of that throughout the country because our footprint is all over the country. And, for instance, we have one roof in one location that is actually testing six different kinds of photovoltaics right now.
Solar panels. Okay.
Sorry. Solar panels.
I knew what you meant, but I just wanted to make sure the listeners knew what you meant.
It's solar panels. And the idea is that in testing those six, and we have help from DOE, if I remember correctly, on that, then we'll be able to see what works best.
It's a fascinating discussion. You're listening to Leading the Way, Federal Green Initiative, sponsored by Noblis. We're back in a moment.
Sustaining our planet's environment will take more than recycling or changing the thermostat. For real change to take place, large organizations must lead the way. Noblis is assisting government agencies and businesses with solutions that help reduce environmental impacts and promote sustainable operations. The President's Executive Order 13514 challenges the federal government to lead in sustainability. Agencies must calculate their greenhouse gas emissions and energy use, then develop a plan for meeting sustainability goals. Noblis thought leaders have developed the GSA Carbon Footprint Tool to help agencies calculate their greenhouse gas emissions and energy use and evaluate options for reduction. Noblis, a nonprofit science, technology, and strategy organization, helps clients solve some of their toughest challenges in healthcare, national security, enterprise transformation, transportation, and sustainability. Noblis, for the best of reasons.
Welcome back to Leading the Way, Federal Green Initiative, sponsored by Noblis. I'm Beverly Kirk. Our panel before the break was talking about climate change and adaptation of agencies. And Michelle Moore from the Federal Environmental Executive, talk about the strategy, the actual federal adaptation strategy that's being worked on literally as we speak.
Well, one of the other aspects of the executive order called for the development of a federal adaptation strategy. And so there's a working group that's jointly chaired by CEQ, OFTP, and NOAA, which is part of the Department of Commerce, that's working on developing exactly that. And in the executive order, there's a deadline of October to prepare a report to the president on the progress that's been made thus far. So very much in the spirit of the ideas that colleagues from Department of the Interior and others have shared on today's panel about practices that their agencies are already putting to work, there's an effort underway to identify how best to coordinate and advance a common strategy across the federal government. And you can actually learn more about that on CEQ's website.
What about coordination between the federal government and state and local governments? Is there any discussion about that?
The Adaptation Working Group has been looking at those questions as well. coordinating with state and local governments, and also international coordination. And so more information about the progress that's been made on that so far by the working group is available on CEQ's website as well.
There was the White House National Climate Adaptation Summit that just occurred about 2 weeks ago here in Washington. I want to ask our panel, how did that summit influence your thinking on climate adaptation and the planning for your specific agency? Ms. Pleffner from Commerce, let's start with you.
Well, I think that emphasized the role that the Department of Commerce needs to play as we as a nation attempt to manage the effects of global climate change. Another example of work that we're doing is we led negotiations at the U.S.-China Joint Commission on Commerce and Trade, and through that, we were able to remove barriers for American firms to compete in China's clean energy market by producing turbines. As Michelle mentioned, NOAA is a co-chair on the Climate Change Adaptation Task Force, and of course, we are very focused on water, on fisheries, on our coastal areas. So NOAA is very active in promoting strategies for those areas and as well as climate change. But as a department, I think we are both inwardly and outwardly focused on the steps that we are taking and will continue to take and want to partner with our communities where we're located so that we can help promote green communities and promote public transportation, promote things like bicycle riding, not just for ourselves, but in our communities as a whole.
Ms. Coffey at State?
Yes, we're part of the segment of this effort to integrate climate change objectives into foreign policy, development assistance, and capacity building efforts. And one of our roles in this is to promote this globally. One of the things I also wanted to mention was it was striking to me when I read through all of the information on the summit is that when we had the Embassy Greening Forum meeting 2 weeks ago, that we had like interests and there were things that were very, very much in common. And the Embassy Greening Forum will take what we're doing in Washington, D.C., and to other foreign capitals as well. Mm-hmm. And so the diplomatic community in foreign capitals, we hope, with our involvement and encouragement and with others, that we will raise the awareness of environmental sustainability and our footprint around the globe.
Dr. Armstrong at Interior?
Yes. I was at the Adaptation Summit, and a couple of points I'd like to make about it. First, I think in conclusion, it was a serious effort to really integrate the science with management and policy. And with the science and management piece and the policy piece as well, to take an end-to-end approach, to really make them a continuum rather than three stovepipes, to make sure that the science is bridged and translated effectively to management decision-making and to policy-making. There was greater emphasis on the role of the U.S. Global Change Research Program, over a $2 billion annual effort coordinating 13 federal agencies. That's really where the rubber meets the road in climate change. The debate is getting away from whether climate change is real to what are we going to do about it, and the role of USGCRP is changing its primary emphasis from understanding just the climate system to understanding the linkage between the climate system, climate change, climate variability, and impacts and effects, as David Evans said earlier, that are felt at the local level and adapted at the local level. And our agency, with the multitude of trust resource responsibilities we have across the country and the globe, as well as our observational and science systems, our legal and policy requirements related to adaptation and climate change, I think it really positions us well to take a leadership role in this evolving new enterprise on adaptation and climate change.
At GSA, you always have the big picture.
Well, we were not, to my knowledge, at the summit, but we are looking forward to the results of the summit to see how we can learn from those results and how to then weave those into our program.
Uh-huh. Let me move to another issue, and I want to speak specifically with Ms. Moore. What are the administration's plans for releasing and making all of the things that we're talking about here today public. I'm sure that there are lots of people who have an interest in the plans the agencies have submitted for how they're going to deal with the sustainability. So what can you tell us about the plan for actually there being a place where people can read about what's going on?
Well, first of all, we're deeply committed to transparency as a part of the work that we're doing under the executive order and the overall GreenGov initiative. And in fact, for CEQ, the GreenGov initiative is our flagship program under open government. So following the review process that we're completing now with OMB, we're looking forward to working in concert with all of the agencies to release the sustainability plan publicly on public websites. So that's something that should be happening later this summer towards the 1st of August.
And for the other members of our panel, how important is it for what you're doing to actually be out there where people can read about what you're doing? Ms. Pleffner, we'll start with you.
I think for the federal government to set the example, it's absolutely vital that our plans be out there. American industry and the American people need to see that our commitment to a green government and sustainability is real and that we are working towards it. We all have challenges with budgets and funds, but the fact that we have these plans in place, we're moving forward, is tangible evidence to the American public that this is real and it can happen.
Ms. Coffey?
Yeah, we put our green guide on our website. This was a request by some of our diplomatic colleagues in Washington 2 weeks ago. And this is a guide that basically explains what our environmental and sustainability footprint is and abroad. And with respect to our plan and our plans going forward and how we accomplish them, yes, they will be made public as well.
And at Interior, Dr. Armstrong.
Well, the Department of the Interior is an advocate of an open and transparent process all the time. And I think that's exemplified by what we're doing in the Gulf right now with that tragedy. But beyond that, with climate change, with all the issues that we face, I go back to what Mary said. I think we, as a federal enterprise, can lead by example. And I think that we'll also find, as David Evans said, in the private and public sectors at state and local levels, a lot of creativity and innovation, which can feed back into our federal plan.
And that segues into what I wanted to ask you about, Dr. Evans, from Noblis. You're there, you're out there, you have a website where people can find out a lot of information about climate change. How important do you feel for it is for what's being done by the government to be out there and accessible by the public?
I think it's essential in a simple word. The private sector, after all, will be the implementer of whatever it is that we decide to do regarding adaptation in particular. If the city of Chicago decides that it needs to increase the size of its storm sewers, for example, it will be a private contractor who actually executes that. Knowing what those opportunities are, knowing what those plans are, knowing the context helps facilitate the smooth flow of that commerce. And I'd like to add one other comment in that regard and with respect to the adaptation summit that we talked about a mm-hmm. minute ago as well. We too were able to participate in that summit, and it struck me that it was a really marvelous opportunity for a nearly equal mix of state and local participants and planners to interact with federal agencies. So as the federal government is moving ahead to develop its adaptation plans, we have a high degree of confidence that they're being done in concert with the needs of people who live in particular places and hope to be the real beneficiaries of those plans. And so that kind of interaction, I believe, would be greatly fostered and enhanced by maximizing the transparency in the federal agency plans and in the processes that go forward. It'll help the state and local folks get their message across and get their needs answered. And frankly, it'll help the private sector be able to help address those needs when the time comes for implementation.
And Dr. Evans, how important is it for that local and state official buy-in to all of this, all of what we're talking about?
I think it's essential. As several of us have commented before, all of the adaptation-related work happens in a particular place. It's fixing the road here. It's deciding how big the conduit is there. It's planning for wintertime storms or floods or whatever. Those are all things that happen in the purview of state and local government, by and large. the 1 in 5 acres, notwithstanding, from the Interior Department, most of the rest of the company is managed by private enterprise in or private stakeholders in one way or another. And those are the folks who are really going to have to make decisions and live in the world that's dramatically changing as we move forward.
And we, during the course of our discussion here, we haven't talked a lot about mitigation, but Dr. Armstrong, you mentioned that early on. What is it that we all need to be looking at in terms of mitigating factors?
Well, I think the most important thing is that the clock is ticking. That if you look at any of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change scenarios, and the most recent national assessments and recent scientific findings, the scenarios are just getting worse. The emission scenarios are just getting worse. And I use the word worse in a strict sense. As long as we continue to talk about mitigation and not take some action at some level, the adaptation efforts that we're going to have to take at both the local and regional levels will be more extreme and more aggressive and less cost-effective and probably less successful. Mm-hmm. So the point I want to make about mitigation across the board is that it is intimately linked to adaptation. It's not one or the other. We have to have a twofold strategy. And I think that a lot of the effort, the spirit, and the intent of 13514 is worthy, but I think a lot of what we're going to see is the grassroots efforts, the creativity and innovation of people both in the federal sector as well as the state and local private sectors coming up from the bottom up and providing a level of idea and innovation that we haven't seen before.
Well, this has been certainly a fascinating discussion on Federal Green Initiative sponsored by Noblis. I want to thank the members of our panel to remind you who we've had speaking here today. Steve Leeds, Senior Counselor to the Administrator for the GSA, the General Services Administration. Marguerite Coffey, Executive Secretariat of Green Diplomacy Initiative at the State Department. Dr. Thomas Armstrong, Senior Advisor on Climate Change at the Department of Interior. Mary Plefner, Director of Administrative Services at the Department of Commerce. Dr. David L. Evans, Director, the Center for Sustainability, Earth, Energy, and Climate at Noblis, and Michelle Moore, Federal Environmental Executive. Thank you all for being here. A fascinating discussion. I'm Beverly Kirk. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for listening to the Noblis Insights panel, Leading the Way, Federal Green Initiatives, on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you missed any portion of this show, you can listen to it in its entirety and on demand at federalnewsradio.com. And if you'd like more information about how the government's getting ready for Executive Order 13514, please go to green.noblis.org.